So imagine it's 2121, and a whole bunch of historical reenactors are getting together to do a reenactment of the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol 100 years before. Well, the first question is, are robots allowed to participate? That'll be like the only question anybody ever asks in 2121. But the other question is, how do you tell the story? Because even now, there's not a commonly agreed upon narrative. Today's show is all about historical reenactors. It is a little bit about that question of commonly agreed upon or disagreed about narratives. It's also remarkably about archaeologists who are trying to reenact what it was like to make tools and other items that very early peoples might have owned and used. Also, who provides the reenactors with their threads and their thread for their threads? All of that and more will be covered.
I was younger than you are now when I was given my first command. I led my men straight into a massacre. I witnessed their deaths firsthand. I made every mistake and felt the shame rise in me. And even now I lie awake, knowing history has its eyes on me. History has its eyes.
So today we're going to talk about historical eyes, the historical gaze, but played out in the present, because there has been for many years a vogue for historical reenactment. I mean, I guess you can sort of take it back 150 years ago to the idea of the tableau vivant, you know, which you might have maybe even in 1850 in some, you know, town centennial or something. I clearly haven't thought this through very well, but it seems to me anyway that it's a little bit like that. But that was, of course, people kind of standing still, dressed in period garb. This is very different. The historical reenactment, obviously, as most of you probably know, is people gathering somewhere, dressed as authentically as they can be, and equipped with as historically authentic equipment as they can possibly obtain, and then reenacting something. It is, as far as I can tell, about 90% of the time it's a battle. But, you know, maybe once in a while they write the Constitution or something. I'm not sure. That's why we have guests on the show. And let's get going with that. I do want to say that the second segment of the show today is going to be what is referred to now in all of National Public Radio as the classic Lily Tyson pivot, because we're going to pivot away from the reenactors as they are commonly understood, and towards archaeologists who are now trying to figure out, well, what was it like for Paleolithic people to build Paleolithic tools? Well, let's try to build some ourselves and see. This is all very fascinating stuff. Let's get going with the reenactors. Brad Kiefer is with us, a professor of history at Kent State University, who's also an active Civil War and colonial period living historian. And first of all, Brad, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Colin. Glad to be here.
So I have, in my usual charmingly fumbling way, attempted to describe what historical reenactment is, but I'm sure you could do a better and very concise job.
No, you did a pretty good job, actually. You know, modern reenacting appeared around the time, at least Civil War reenacting. Now, we probably shouldn't get too pigeonholed here, mm-hmm. because there are people reenacting all kinds of things. I mean, somewhere out there, there are people doing Roman legionnaires, mm-hmm. bless their hearts. So the start of reenactment usually is triggered by the need to remember the event being reenacted. So even though there were probably guys doing some sort of playing out battles in the decades after the Civil War, for example, the real desire to reenact the Civil War comes out of the centennial, when the last of the veterans are gone. So there's a connection that's made, I think, between particularly military reenactors, but all reenactors, between the people they're portraying and themselves and the community they build around that portrayal. And some of, you know, for Civil War reenactors, we're reaching back to these idealized veterans and trying to recreate the war that they described in their memoirs.
Right. And so this thing, this kind of thing probably ebbs and flows a little bit. I would imagine that it flowed, particularly around the time of, well, let's just play A1 Cat. I think it probably flowed rather than ebbed around the time of this.
Dear Sarah, the indications are very strong that we shall move in a few days, perhaps tomorrow. And lest I should not be able to write you again, I feel impelled to write a few lines that may fall under your eye when I am no more. I have no misgivings about or lack of confidence in the cause in which I am engaged, and my courage does not halt or falter. I know how American civilization now leans upon the triumph of the government, and how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and suffering of the revolution. And I am willing, perfectly willing, to lay down all my joys in this life to help maintain this government and to pay that debt.
So, Brad, yeah, in the 1960s, we get the centennial. In the 1980s, there's also this incredible Civil War boom. It's led by Ken Burns. That, of course, is the famous Sullivan Ballou letter. You're hearing, by the way, David McCullough, who recently died, the great historian David McCullough, read that letter. But so suddenly, wow, it's just in everybody's – it's Vietnam was supposedly the living room war. But for a while, the American Civil War was the living room war.
And that – that film came out right at the tail end of the 125th anniversary of the war. And those 125th reenactments were some of the biggest that had ever been held. So the hobby was already rolling pretty well in the late 80s. And then, yeah, the Civil War propelled it. Glory, which used a bunch of reenactors and actually recruited African-Americans for the reenactment community, was another push. And then by the time we get to the early 90s, we have Ted Turner's Gettysburg that has a cast of thousands literally made out of reenactors. And so for the next 10 years, the reenactment community grew, the scenarios, the battles grew, they got sponsors, they got hooked up with preservation. And yeah, that was the golden age of reenacting.
And when we say golden age and when we say some of the largest reenactments, I mean, forget about Ted Turner for a second. We're talking about reenactors just for their own sake, reenacting, say, the Battle of Gettysburg, and you've got thousands of people there?
I believe it was the 135th Gettysburg that had close to 20,000 participants. That's including civilians, of course, and the sutlers. But we saw Pickett's Charge. I'm a Union reenactor, so I'm up there on the ridge. We saw Pickett's Charge done with roughly 10,000 Confederate infantry.
Wow, that is something.
And yeah, it was quite the spectacle. But even the 125th, there was a guy named Foley who made Classic Images videos, and they're all re-released now by an outfit called Lionheart Videos. And he filmed really well the 125th sequence. And his Gettysburg had, there were 11,000 in 1988. And that almost doubled then by the time we did the 135th in 1998. And that was the peak. The 135th really had the numbers where you were talking 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 participants.
So another thing that has happened recently, and I'm not suggesting that history and historical reality haven't been contested over the decades, but we seem to have been moving into a much more contentious area where even formerly commonly agreed upon narratives are argued about, and there are questions, and these questions spill over not just into reenactments, but so-called living history. People go to an actual site of a former plantation, and sometimes there's a pretty chilling narrative about what it was really like to be a slave, and a lot of information is given there. Some people don't want that. They want to go to the plantation that looks more like Gone with the Wind, and everybody's pretty happy. But everything's like that, right? I mean, if you're going to do a reenactment, you're going to charge into battle in some cases with a battle flag from the Confederacy, and that is just loaded up, totally freighted with all kinds of contemporary social stuff. So what does that do? What does all that, I don't know, nervous tension do for the or to the reenacting community?
Well, at the time where things really got hairy, around 2016, 17, after Charlottesville, there was a lot of concern that there was going to be a real sort of violent public reaction. And the Confederates kind of played it cool. You know, there are other flags that units can carry that are less contentious than the battle flag, regimental flags, state flags, even the Confederate national flag early in the war was pretty unpretentious. Our concerns peaked in 2016 at the Cedar Creek reenactment in Middletown, Virginia. It was an annual event held on the actual battlefield where somebody found a pipe bomb and everybody freaked out. There was a lot of speechifying among reenactors about how we needed to stick together and protect one another, and how this was also inappropriate. As it turned out, and we didn't know this until 2 years later, it wasn't outside forces. It was an inside job. It was some disgruntled guy who, you know, who sabotaged his own hobby.
Wow. Like,
which was just shockingly, you know, mind-boggling. But there were, you know, there after that incident, there were, you know, there were some real concerns. They haven't really played out. I like to say that our job as Civil War reenactors is to portray the military war. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't civilians and sanitary commission and all kinds of other impressions that people do. But for our purpose, we interpret the war, the battlefield, the weapons, the lifestyle of the soldiers. And doing that doesn't excuse the fact that the Confederates were fighting for a pretty bad cause, but it allows them to portray Confederates in a way that sort of focuses on the army rather than the cause.
Right. I mean, in other words, you know, I think we'd think differently about John C. Calhoun than we would think about an average Confederate soldier who's, you know,
right,
in his regiment for whatever reason. So I want to go back to that initial centennial boom in the 60s. So that's where maybe people like you start to get attracted to it. Now, the problem with this is that it's not the 1960s or it's not the 1980s or whatever anybody got involved. And so I'm wondering about the demographic issue here, because the kids come along and they've got other options, including cosplay. You know, they can,
right,
can go to Comic-Con and dress up as their favorite Avenger or whatever. And I'm wondering whether, just as this is the case with any prolonged war, getting fresh young bodies into uniform is a problem.
It is. The hobby is aging and proportionally shrinking because of that. Look, you know, in the 1960s, I was a grade school kid and I read Bruce Catton and I read the sort of basic works, Billy Yank and Johnny Reb by Bell Wiley. And a lot of my contemporaries have. So we all came into reenacting with this very idealized sense of the war and the veterans and the soldiers. Now, the simplest answer to your question is that the people who are still recruiting a significant number of young folks are bringing them to the reenactments as kids. They're family camp reenactors, right? So rather than have a stripped down military camp at a big reenactment, you'll find a village full of canvas, full of dining flies and furniture, period, enough, and kids. And they raise their replacements from pups. They literally raise them up from kids.
Well, I don't know what percentage of them will ultimately rebel against that and say, oh, good, I'm free. I don't have to do this anymore. But
I'm sure a bunch of them do. Absolutely. But there, it is a pipeline that a lot of units like the one I belong to don't have.
Right.
You know,
so
we're not a family reunion.
Yeah. Can we talk about what we might think of as method acting? So, you know, I don't know, if I were a Revolutionary War or American Civil War reenactor, I think I'd be showing up in some kind of pretty comfortable RV and, you know, I'd get out, get my uniform on, do my thing, get back in, you know, open up a nice Chardonnay. But really, if you're going to do this, you know, and I know there are some people who feel like they've got to march 18 miles to the battle in really crappy shoes, eating a hardtack or whatever the equivalent
right.
of that is now. So can you talk a little bit about that, the sort of people who kind of parachute in versus the people who are really method actors about this?
Back in 1999, Tony Horowitz wrote
yes.
Confederates in the Attic, and he did a beautiful job of separating the hardcores, as he called them, Who are the guys that, right, wanted to sleep in the dirt and wear their uniform for a week and eat hardtack. And the mainstream reenactors, often referred to as the FARBs, who didn't necessarily want to suffer. To me, there's always been an in-between. You know, I'm going to sleep in the tent on the ground. I'm going to eat, as you know, the food that we can cook that's period enough. To me, reenacting is a visceral experience. And if you don't experience a little misery and a little hardship and sleep in the cold a couple of times and endure the heat, you're missing part of the experience. You know, so the RV reenactors are missing really the whole point. Sure, they're on the battlefield. They increase the numbers. A lot of those guys are artillerists, so they drag their cannons on the back of an RV or back a pickup truck and tend to not necessarily need to do what the infantry does, which is go sleep in the dirt. So if you're cheating completely, you're missing it. I don't think you need to be a hardcore roll around in the dirt and be miserable all the time. And those guys are so persnickety, we call them stitch counters, right? That they're always going, that's not authentic. Those buttons didn't go on that coat. Nobody likes them.
No. By the way, at the end of the show today, we're going to be talking to Ian Graves, who's one of the people who provides the thread that they stitch with and all the other stuff, too. He is one of the suppliers of historical reenactment garb. No, I want to sort of have you take off your Union cap and put on your historian hat. And I know all the historians have a historian hat that they wear.
So
just talk about, this is one piece of understanding history. But I would assume from your perspective, it's only one piece of understanding history. It's not a way to come to some kind of fuller understanding of history.
Right. And I would go a little further. I would say that reenacting is very much a mix of history and memory. Because the memories that reenactments are built on are very selected ones. Some of them a little bit flawed, right? The Lost Cause is a memory structure, not a historical one. And so when you see the veterans in a very idealized way, those old guys shaking hands at the wall, right? 1913, these old codgers all go to the wall in Gettysburg and they shake hands. That's the idealized memory that inspires us, right? That we can celebrate the reunion of North and South by reliving the lives of these guys, reliving their experiences, remembering them, holding them up, talking about their regiments. And so it's history, and it's really good. Civil War reenactors know military history. Many of them are very well read. But yeah, they're not historians. They're not theorists. They're not placing what they do into some sort of larger context. As a historian, I know exactly where it fits. And I've written a couple of things for scholarly sources that talk about reenacting and battlefield preservation, which is a real interesting sort of spinoff. And again, speaks to our archaeologists who are on later, right? The whole idea of preserving and identifying artifacts, and landscapes are artifacts. And then the sentimentalized the nature of all of this and the memory function. And so, yeah, it can make it real complicated if I want to. But it comes down to what people want to remember about the war and what they want to experience.
So I want you to take your historian hat off, put the reenactor hat on, and don't now tell me what describe the moment that makes it all feel worth it. All right. Because you are you're not it sounds like you're not an RV reenactor. You are somewhat committed to some of the physical discomfort and perhaps actual suffering that goes into this. It's not something you do just to have fun all day long. So describe the moment where you're thinking, this is worth it. This is why I do this.
You know, ironically, one of those moments was my very first major reenactment in 1989, the Battle of Spotsylvania in 1864. And I'm brand new. I'm green as grass, man. And the attack, the big climax of the reenactment of the battle is an attack on a Confederate position called the Mule Shoe, which was a trench system. And the attack was launched at the crack of dawn, literally. We marched in the dark to be in position. 4,000 Yankees in columns. And we hit that thing as the sun was coming up. And the battle that broke out was the most realistic, fierce. And the whole time the sun is rising. Man, I get goosebumps just thinking about it. That hooked me. I mean, you talk about being hooked. About 35 years later, I've been to a lot of good reenactments. The cornfield at Antietam, where you wade into a standing cornfield at daybreak. The sunken road at Antietam. Just so realistic and you know, memorable. But that first one, man, I was hooked.
All right, Brad Giever, you're just a great guest on this subject. Professor of History at Kent State University. Kent State University is going to play a major role in the show today because our next guests are also from there, also an active Civil War and colonial period living historian. We're going to take a little break, and we will come back, and we will meet the people who do the Paleolithic stuff.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Hartford HealthCare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers, so we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford HealthCare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Yes, here comes the hammer and all the other Stone Age tools. There just aren't really great rap singles about them. But where do they come from? Where did they come from? What was it like to try to make one? And for that, we have, and I swear to God, Lily Tyson, the producer of this episode, did not walk around the Kent State campus just buttonholing people. It just has worked out that we have a lot of Kent State participation today. So joining us is Metin Aaron, associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at Kent State University, where he's also the co-director of the Kent State University Experimental Archaeology Laboratory. Also with us, Michelle Beber, an associate, I could do the same thing all over again, basically associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at Kent State University, where she is also the co-director of the Kent State University Experimental Archaeology Laboratory. There was a more efficient way to introduce these two people, but I didn't come up with it. So Metin, maybe get us started here. I mean, you're doing a kind of reverse engineering here, right? You're taking maybe something that we have artifacts of and then trying to figure out how somebody made it X thousand years ago.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And reverse engineering is, I think, the best way to describe experimental archaeology, where we want to understand how these really old tools were made and how they worked. And unlike maybe more historical sciences where they have texts or even videos or photographs, we don't have any of that stuff in the prehistoric record. So the only way we can figure out how all this really old stuff works is by making it and using it ourselves.
Right. So, I mean, the good news is nobody's going to show up and go, that's not how we did it. That's where you've got that wrong. But I'm also wondering, how far back do you go? I mean, are we going back all the way to the Paleolithic era, to, you know, lower Paleolithic, as they say?
Yeah, so we've recreated ancient technologies going back to the very first stone tools over 3 million years ago. And then we will continue all the way to cultures just before European contact in prehistoric North America.
Right. So, and Michelle, I'm very interested to know if the undergraduates, the incoming class people have to go out and stand in a field and pretend to be glyptodons while you guys hunt them with spears that you just made. Because that seems like a very tough form of hazing.
Yeah, that would be rough. I mean, we do take them out in the field if they want to, and we do addle day for all the students, and they love it. I often have them compare what it's like to throw a heavy spear, something that would have happened maybe 400,000 years ago, versus using an addle, which is a spear thrower, which we know from at least the upper Paleolithic. And that's usually a really fun hands-on experience for them. And I think they're really surprised at the benefits offered by the invention of a spear thrower. So yeah, we use foam targets usually. No one ever gets hurt.
Well, that's your story. But
knock on wood.
Yeah. So Michelle, I mean, another part of this is when, I mean, it's like watching a video of all this, which I did, is fascinating, because when I think of artifacts like this, when I think of things that I would go to a museum and look at, the actual artifacts, they're incredibly precious and have to be handled that way. What you guys are doing is making a close approximation of these things, but then you are throwing it at trees, because you, and like I watched this one thing where somebody threw a spear and it broke, and that was good, right? Because you wanted to know how it broke. Say some more about that.
So I think the video you might have seen was actually on
Atlas Obscura.
Yeah. And so we went out and threw some atlatls, and he did hit a tree with it. It was a great shot. Actually, I don't know if he was meaning to hit a tree, but he did. And it stuck in perfectly and left a really nice impact scar on the stone tool. So that's really what we're trying to get at. What was it like to use these things? What do the breakage patterns tell us about what people were doing in the past? Because in the end of the day, we look at artifacts, but we're really trying to understand human behavior and how they made these things, how they used these things, and eventually how these tools changed over time. And it's pretty interesting. So yeah, it's fun, but we really get a lot of good information out of doing the experiments.
Right. So Metin, I mean, you know, throwing spears is really fun, but a lot of the stuff that you do is really painstaking work. And so I think now is the time for you to explain to us about flint napping. That's K-N-A-P-P-I-N-G, not going to sleep with a piece of flint. Oh, so how do you do this?
Yeah. So flint napping is the process of making stone tools via flaking or chipping. And so a lot of people think that stone tool making, whether you're making an arrowhead or an axe or something like that, because it's stone, you have to use a lot of power and you're just really, you know, banging on these rocks. But flint napping really is all about finesse and angles. And as long as you can understand how particular rocks break, it's actually one of the most relaxing things that you can do once you've mastered the technique. And so what we do, though, is we recreate different arrowheads or spearheads or anything like that. And then we can figure out how different styles work in different ways. So some arrowheads penetrate a target better. Some arrowheads are more durable. Some arrowheads may have certain aerodynamic qualities. And by understanding like how all this stuff is made and functioned, they serve as models for comparisons to the artifacts that we actually dig up. And so for the last 150 years, archaeologists have been digging up all sorts of arrowheads and stone tools and sort of just proclaiming, oh, this kind of stone tool was used for this purpose. And I think at some point, both Michelle and I just looked at each other and said, well, how do you know that? How do you know that a stone tool was used in that way, or that stone tool worked better than another stone tool? And then it just occurs to folks who do experimental archaeology that, well, you can test these sort of proclamations from the last 100 years by using and testing these things ourselves in very sophisticated either ballistics tests or engineering tests.
All right. So, Michelle, we have a little slogan here on this show. It's Neanderthals rule, other hominins drool. probably literally drool. I mean, this is another really interesting question, right? You've got sort of different kinds of hominins running around making different kinds of tools. And I'm kind of I have a lot of Neanderthal DNA. I'm a Neanderthal activist. I'm kind of tired of hearing some of the stuff that gets said about us. But this is another opportunity that you have, right? Is, all right, who's making what tools and who's as good at it as or worse at it than anybody else? And give a kind of sense of what you learn about that.
I think overall, what we do tends to just shed light on how sophisticated and intelligent our ancestors were, whether it's a Neanderthal or even Homo erectus. They were doing very sophisticated techniques to make these tools. There's a lot of abstract thought in designing something in your head and then producing it. You're essentially almost making a sculpture out of a rock, which is very interesting and difficult to do. So I think one of the main things, and it's exciting for me, is to see my students understand how amazing it was that people were able to do this in the past and how they were able to invent different technologies over time, whether it's Neanderthals who figured out how to, make bitumen essentially, or do controlled fire to heat treat a stick to make it more durable. That's actually quite sophisticated and difficult to do. So I think there's something exciting about figuring out how people did these things, 100,000 years ago or beyond, and sharing that with the public or students in a very tangible, hands-on way. So I think it's great.
So I'm also thinking, Michelle, that there's a way in which, I don't know if empathy is the right word, but I mean, doing this kind of stuff, I mean, this is why it's part of a show that we're doing on historical reenactment. You are, in a way, putting yourself in, I guess, not necessarily in the shoes of a prehistoric person, but you're putting them in a place where they were. And could you say a little bit about that? I mean, does it help you kind of psychologically align with this whole period that you're thinking about?
Yeah, I think so. As anthropologists, we tend to, obviously we admire and adore everyone in the past, but I do think there tends to be amongst the public this idea that people in the past were, primitive, which is not a good word to use, but it gets used all the time. And I do think that just being able to do these things in a hands-on way connects you to just the mind, perhaps, of people in the past. Some things that look really easy are actually quite hard, like flint knapping. It's very difficult to learn. Whereas other things that we perceive as being super complex or complicated, like working with early copper, which is something that I do, it's actually quite easy. Students have learned how to make metal arrowheads within about 45 minutes. So I think sort of just it adjusts how you conceptualize these things in the past. And rather than just having this gut reaction of, oh, that was easy and simplistic versus, oh, this is super sophisticated and sort of progressive, is something that you can glean, I think, from doing these things yourself and having that experience of producing these tools.
So, Metin, I don't know how widespread the activities involved in experimental archaeology are, but I'm guessing it's sort of a growth field in the sense that gradually we're going to start, running out of artifacts to find. So is this, in fact, sort of a little bit of the future of archaeology as we will know it?
Yeah, 100%. In fact, there is a paper published by the archaeologist Todd Surivel and colleagues in 2017 that was entitled The End of Archaeological Discovery. And in that paper, they do some very sophisticated modeling, and they actually show that we are, for all intents and purposes, running out of archaeological sites. On top of that, archaeology fieldwork can be expensive. And there's really important ethical and moral decisions to be made as to whether sites should be dug up. And when they're dug up, you have to make sure that you've got indigenous partners that are helping you and involved in that research if the research is going forward. So for all of these reasons, like traditional archaeology, I think it's not on the way out, but it's certainly not the future. And I think what we're seeing is that experimental archaeology, recreating all these artifacts that have been dug up over the last 150 years, is the future. It's relatively inexpensive to do. We are learning all sorts of things. Our lab publishes 15 to 20 papers a year simply because there is so much low-hanging fruit. And students get to get exposed to art, engineering, mathematics, anthropology. Experimental archaeology really is sort of a cornucopia of all sorts of different disciplines. And so, it's definitely a growth field.
So, Metin, I have to ask you about one other thing, and I apologize for asking about it, but let's face it, you're never going to do an interview for the rest of your life where somebody doesn't ask you about this, and 50 years from now or 80 years from now, it's going to be the lead in your New York Times obituary. So let's talk about the poop knife.
All right. Yeah. So, and also, Dr. Beber was a co-author and participant in that study as well.
I noticed she didn't leap to lay claim to that somehow. Yeah, I know she didn't really spring in there and say, "Hey, what about me and the poop knife?"
Yeah. This is a story that I heard for the first time on NPR when I was 16 years old. It was on the Diane Rehm show, and the anthropologist and ethnobotanist Wade Davis had just published a book in 1996 called Shadows in the Sun. And in that story, he talks about an Inuit man who was in a survival situation and had no tools and so basically defecated into his own hands. And because he was in the Canadian Arctic, as his feces froze, he honed it into the shape of a knife. And he was able to kill a dog and butcher that dog with that poop knife, turned the dog's rib cage into a sled, turned the dog's hide into a harness, and he harnessed another dog and sped off into the night. And I heard that story when...
And you thought, how hard could it be?
Well, what I thought was, when I was 16 years old, hearing this story in 1996, anthropology is amazing. And so little did I know, 20 years later, I'd be co-director of this amazing lab we have here at Kent State. And I was thinking of our next project to do in the lab. And I remember texting Dr. Beber and just saying, "Hey, I've got a great idea for our project." And she wrote back, "Well, what is it?" And all I said was, "Do you remember the Wade Davis story?" And then there was silence. And then I see the little text dots. And she writes back, "Oh my God."
Because I did.
And so, because she can sort of predict, I think, what I'm thinking most of the time. And so what we did was we thought this is a great urban legend, because if you go online, this story of the poop knife has really just exploded. I'm sorry for that word, but has exploded all over the internet, and people just accept it as fact. And there's, if you have a chance to look at the actual paper, we document why there's reasons to believe that maybe it didn't occur. But one piece of evidence that questions it would be, does a poop knife actually work? And so we went on some very strict diets that would be consistent with an Arctic diet. And we produced the necessary raw materials and actually then conducted a butchery experiment with all the ethical approvals from Kent State, of course, although they were a little confused. Yeah, and so we showed scientifically that given the conditions in our study that a knife manufactured from frozen human feces does not work.
You did win some kind of Ig Nobel Award for this, correct?
Well, the Ig Nobel Prize Awards are for the funniest science, and it's for science that first makes you laugh and then makes you think, and they've been going on for decades. So we were very honored to have won the 2020 Ig Nobel for material science for our poop knife study.
Well, listen, first of all, Metin Aaron and Michelle Beber, both co-directors of the Kent State University Experimental Archaeology Laboratory, go Golden Flashes, and thanks for being with us today. We are going to head into our final segment, which I don't think has any connection to Kent State, but who knows? Maybe everybody went there or something. We'll find out.
Such teeth there, and it shows them pearly white, just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bite with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows.
Hi, this is Colin McEnroe. You're listening to a podcast right now. You probably know that. But if you were listening on the air, you'd also know we're in the middle of a fun drive. And even though you're not listening on the air, you're listening to a podcast. That doesn't change the fact that we need your support. And one way that you can support this show that you maybe even love or at least like is to visit ctpublic.org/donate and make a donation today. Thanks for everything that you do already. We are very grateful. All right, we are back. Time to do some thank yous, starting with Kat Pastor, our technical producer, the one playing all the music and the clips and the guests and everything. We are also produced in this particular episode by our senior producer, Lily Tyson. And of course, it's all hands on deck here. So Jonathan McPants has been running around making sure the music is just right. It even kind of created a version of the Hamilton tune we opened with that doesn't really exist independently of him. All right. So in our final segment, we're going to go back to the more conventional ideas about what reenacting is, historical reenacting. With us, I sort of teased this before, Ian Graves is a tailor and owner of Royal Blue Traders, specializing in the American Revolutionary War, the clothing of the American Revolutionary War. Also with us, J.R. Hardman, an associate professor at PBS Utah and a Civil War reenactor who is directing and producing a documentary titled Reenactress. So, Ian, I'm going to begin with you. You might have heard Brad talking at the beginning too about stitch counters, I think they're called, the people who really are fussy about how things have to be, even right down to their garments. I would assume that's a little bit of your clientele, right? People who really feel like they need to get the waistcoat or something right.
Yeah, that's what I do. I make things historically accurately, and I do things only by hand. So I actually really don't use a sewing machine. So I do literally sit there and count the stitches.
Right. And there's sort of a commonality between that and the thing we just talked about with the archaeological reenactors. People who are in your business, you know, as you say, you could use a sewing machine, but that kind of wrecks the idea. You're trying to make it more or less the way that it was made. I also read about, I mean, there's one of your and somebody else in your business, John Townsend, making a wooden whisk and insisting on getting the right kind of birch twigs in Michigan where the right kind of trees grow and all this kind of stuff. You guys, as much as you can, are, I guess, not just making it look right, but making it in a way that kind of parallels how it was made?
Yeah, we hold the material culture of the hobby to be very serious. So we do things as accurately as possible. We use the right threads. We use mohair threads for buttonholes, silk threads for buttonholes, linen thread to sew things together. It is very meticulous. There's mills in England that are actually reproducing authentic fabric for the American Revolutionary War period uniforms. Like we really go in all in on it to make it as accurate as possible.
And so, I don't know, I mean, just price range here a little bit. I mean, this can't, the kind of work that you're talking about, the kind of curational edge that this whole project has, it's labor intensive for you. It can't possibly be cheap. I mean, I don't know, let's say I want a coat like the ones I see in Hamilton or something. What's that going to run me?
I just did a batch of uniforms for a unit, a group, the 10th Regiment of Foot, based in Massachusetts, and I did a coat for a sergeant, and it was something around $1,500 just for the coat itself, I believe is what I charged him, between fabric and buttons and the buttonhole twist, the braid that went around the buttonholes as well. Like, it was about $1,500 for the coat. And my labor.
That actually sounds pretty reasonable. I was actually guessing higher numbers than that. So,
well, I did do a coat for the USS Constitution for their Marine Corps volunteers on board. It was their officer coat, and that one was about $2,200 for the coat with fabric and all the above. Yeah.
So, I'm just curious, how did you wind up doing this? How did this wind up being a field for you? It isn't something you can very easily prepare yourself for or go to a school for.
Well, I started when I was about 11, and I went to a local historical house's open house day, and there was this guy in a red coat, and I said, "What was that?" And he said, "I'm a red coat." And I said, "How can I do that?" And then I started reenacting. I got my family into it. And then I just started sewing when I was at university because I preferred doing that to university because I had grown up in universities because my parents are both teachers.
All right. So
I just started sewing.
Yeah. So I don't know. I feel like there's some kind of joke here. Like I could have the pants ready for you by 1775. The coat is going to take till 1777.
So I've made that joke a few times.
Oh, you made it. Okay.
Yeah.
So I feel better. Either I feel better or worse about making it then. So, but to that point, there is variation, right? There's variation within a historical arc, within the arc of the American Revolution. The clothes they're wearing in 1775 are probably different from 1778.
They are, yeah. The British Army in particular went through a lot of changes. So when I make a coat for somebody in the British Army, like a red coat, a very important part of that is what year. Are we doing this 1775? Are we doing 1781? What campaign are you with? Are you with Burgoyne? Are you with Clinton? Are you with Howe? All of this matters a lot because the type of legwear, whether it be gaitered trousers or straight trousers or breeches, style of your gaiters, how cut down is your coat, all things like that. It matters a lot, and the uniform is very massively. So there's a lot of research that goes in to make sure you do this about as correct as is humanly possible.
So let me bring J.R. Hardman into this conversation. As I said, J.R. Hardman is in the process of making a documentary called Reenactress. So J.R. Hardman, first of all, I mean, the title's a little bit of a giveaway. You're really interested in the roles of women, the kinds of things that women wind up doing within this subculture. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So my film focuses mostly on the Civil War era. But I have explored a little bit of other war eras. I think something that maybe people don't all know is that women have served in military roles in every American war that has been fought by American soldiers. In the Civil War, most of the women who served in military roles were actually disguising themselves as men. So there's some authenticity concerns surrounding that. The participation of women in military roles isn't always extremely well accepted in the hobby. And that's a lot of what my film explores, is what does it mean to be physically authentic and what does it mean to create an authentic experience?
So this is the film pretty specifically oriented towards that? You're not interested in women representing the United States Sanitary Commission or something like that? I think Brad referred to that in our first segment.
So I have done some research on women in medical roles and women who were serving openly as women. But most of my film is focused specifically on women who were soldiers.
So, you know, I mean, I was talking to Brad Reefer at the beginning of the show about, because everything seems to be contested ground these days. And particularly, you know, we're less able at times to even have agreed upon narratives, either about the present or the past, from which we can either build consensus or not. And I'm wondering about this, too. You're talking about something that might, in fact, clash with some dude's idea of what the Civil War was. And I'm wondering if you do get pushback about that, or if the women get pushback about that.
Oh, absolutely. I'm participating in the hobby as a reenactor in a military role, and we definitely get pushback. A lot of it's actually surrounding the online community, and so a lot of the pushback that we get is from completely random strangers that have never met us and have never been on the field with us. But I think that there is a tendency amongst people who are trying to be as historically authentic as possible to say, by having a woman present and by having a woman portraying a man, it breaks the illusion that what we're doing is 100% authentic. However, from a theatrical standpoint, people have been doing gender bending in theatrical roles, and the audience has bought it for centuries. You can think about Shakespearean times when men were portraying women on stage and women were never on stage. So I think that there's a lot of elements that go into making the experience feel authentic. And I think as a woman or as a person of color portraying maybe somebody that wasn't the same ethnicity as you are, there is a way to do method acting surrounding the experience, and there is a way to try to envision yourself as being like a person, even if you are not physically matching that person exactly.
Makes a lot of sense. Hey, Ian, I want to come back to you for just a second here. We're almost out of time, but you know, I actually am seriously wondering. I mean, the American Revolutionary War is your period, and you sometimes do stuff involving the French army under Rochambeau. I'm just wondering, I mean, was Hamilton kind of a big thing in the world of reenactors, or maybe even pushing a new wave of reenactors towards this? You see all this on stage, you see the costumes, you see all this stuff. I would imagine it would get people kind of excited.
It did get a lot of people really excited. We did get a lot of my own unit didn't get a lot of recruits because of it, but we did get a lot of questions about, oh, you're French. And they actually understood that the French were here. So it did get a new interest in historical interpretation and the American Revolution. It did also spur a lot of new members into the hobby too, which was really nice.
Right. And I mean, since you do work, I guess, on the French costumes, must be their own challenge, right? Just even in terms of trying to recreate something like that.
Oh, yeah. The French army is very different than any other army in Europe. It's all white. So the fabric is all white. You have a white coat, you have white breeches, white waistcoat, white gaiters. So keeping everything clean is actually quite hard, but you actually find that things come out of wool pretty easily. But it's very different than British Army or American Army or even American civilian, which is very fun to interpret that and discover it.
Yeah, it does sound very cool. All right. Ian Graves, tailor and owner of Royal Blue Traders. Start ordering your Christmas presents or something. He specializes in American Revolutionary War clothing. J.R. Hardman, an associate producer at PBS Utah and a Civil War reenactor, is producing and directing documentary titled Reenactress.
Find my